Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Each week, our host will introduce you to a various cast of characters you will only find here. Each host will share experience, knowledge, and expertise regarding their years in the fire service, allowing you to call in and speak with them live, an experience you can only find on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy and stay safe.
Good evening. Welcome to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. This is May 13th, Friday the 13th, 2011, and it's 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and actually it's quite a bit earlier where we're broadcasting from this week. I'm Mike McAvoy, and this is Fire Medically Speaking, and we're at the Fire Rescue Med Conference in Las Vegas. Unlike most trips to Vegas, this is an educational conference, and so we're with the International Association of Fire Chiefs this week and talking about the show here in Vegas. And I think we'll very shortly have a caller to bring on the air who can tell us a little bit more about the International Association of Fire Chiefs, the Fire Rescue Med Conference. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in calling in to take a listen to our topic this evening, and feel free to give a call and join in with the conversation. What I'd like to do is bring Chief Gary Ludwig on the air. Gary is the Deputy Fire Chief for Memphis Fire Department in Tennessee. And welcome, Chief Ludwig. You're on the air with us.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me on the air. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I want to congratulate you on this really good EMS conference that we're at here in Las Vegas. And I thought maybe you could just take a few minutes of your time. I know you're stepping out of a session to do this, and tell us a little bit about Fire Rescue Med. Maybe we can talk some about the EMS section also.
Sure, Mike. this is our 14th year here in Las Vegas at the Orleans Hotel. And we started Fire Rescue Med, obviously, 14 years ago, with the clear intent of creating a conference that was designed for fire EMS chiefs who have to manage fire-based EMS systems. And one of the things that we saw lacking within the conferences that were provided was that there wasn't really a focus on fire-based EMS issues. And so we have many challenges in fire-based EMS, management of fire-based EMS systems. And so we wanted to provide those chief officers out there who are managing fire-based EMS systems, programs on leadership, issues that they need to be aware of when it comes to managing their systems, and items of importance that are hard-hitting within our profession at the time. And so we started this conference called Fire Rescue Med. And as I like to tell people, if you're coming here to learn how to start an IV or do some other type of clinical type of course or learn some other type of clinical information, this is not the program for you. We're not here on clinical issues on what is the latest drug for an asthmatic or some other type of methodology for a treatment. We're here again to discuss the issues that impact fire-based EMS systems legislatively, administratively, operationally. And that's the focus of our conference on leadership and a variety of other topics that would impact any fire-based EMS system.
So it's pretty different than the clinical things that we see, like, for example, at the EMS Today show and even at FDIC, where we do more clinical than management things. This is really a conference for people that are running fire-based EMS.
Yes, exactly. And I'll give you an example of some of the programs we had going on here today. We had the EMS chiefs, the operations chief, and the chief in charge of logistics who handled Tucson shooting, where Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was shot. They had a total of 20 people shot there, and so they kind of dissected how they handled that situation. Historically how it occurred, as far as their response went, how they managed multi-casualty events within their community, the resources they used, and the outcomes that they saw, and the triage procedures that they at that we learned that they did not use. There was no triage that actually occurred there, and it was by design.
Wow.
And so we learned, those who attended that session learned a lot of different things there. And earlier this week, we had Dennis Rubin, who is a former fire chief of Atlanta and Washington, D.C., give us some examples of military actions, I guess the best way to describe it, Mike, is the way the military and how they do things interfaces into us as leaders in the fire service. He gave 10 different case studies of that.
Yeah,
and
that was
also,
interesting. Marine Corps principles.
Yeah, Marine Corps principles. That's exactly right. And so he sat. He did that, and that afternoon he did a kind of a journey where he had a bunch of lemons in his career, and how he turned them into lemonade. That was the title of his talk, which was lemons into lemonade, and a journey through his career. And there's been a variety of different things. We had people here talking about Kathy Weston, infectious disease, and the latest updates on how infectious disease and all the issues impacting infectious disease, which I know, Mike, you sit with her on our Emerging Diseases Committee. And as you know, she is also very knowledgeable on these topics. And
Brian Bledsoe was here talking, and actually Randy Mantooth was teaching with Brian and I in a rehab class for people in firefighter rehab. So
exactly, the 1584 program. And so, you know, it is not the clinical issues. I mean, there are operational issues. There's administrative issues. There's leadership issues. But our classes pretty much cover the gamut for those who are managing fire-based EMS systems.
Yeah. All right. Hey, so Gary, could you just take a second maybe to talk a little bit about the iChiefs and the EMS section for people that might be interested in joining?
Sure, absolutely. The International Association of Fire Chiefs has different sections, our specialty interest group areas, and one of those is EMS. So we, as the EMS section, are one of those special interest areas of the IAFC. So members who are members of the IAFC, or let me rephrase that, chiefs who are members of the IAFC can also join different specialty areas. And so we have members who have joined us, and we have about 1,400 members in the EMS section. Excuse me, I got a little frog in my throat. And one of the things that we're doing is, as a section, is we're representing the interests of those who are involved in fire-based EMS on the national level. We interact with Congress on legislative issues. We represent the fire service on a variety of different topics, from Medicare, the Ryan White Comprehensive Health Care Act, which was in front of Congress, and on infectious disease. Right now we're dealing with the Affordable Care Act and how that impact is going to be on how it would impact the fire service. And just a host and gamut of different issues of legislation that comes up in front of Congress each year. And then we liaison and work with other national EMS organizations, and there's a whole host of those. National Association of EMTs, National Registry, National Association of EMS Physicians, American College of Emergency Physicians, and I can just go through the litany of all of them that are out there. But we interface and work with all of them. Sometimes we don't see eye to eye on some of those topics, but at the same time we do dialogue with them and work on them. And then we have various items that we offer our membership as far as communication goes. We have 9 different forms of communication where we're constantly pumping out information to our members about what is impacting fire service EMS, the current issues. And, we send out a monthly email blast. We have a newsletter. We have an on-scene column in the IFC's newsletter. We have a Facebook page that we send information out. Mike, as you know, you administrate our Google group. So we have 9 different forms of communication we're constantly pumping information out to our members, and there's a bunch of other items that we've provided to our members. Those are some of the main topics that we do for our members.
That's a good information sharing sort of service. So there's a website, IAFC, the International Association of Firefighters.org, and then there's also the EMS section webpage, which is IAFCEMS.org. People could
go
to either of those sites to get some information on joining.
Absolutely. And we have a whole host of information and resources on our webpage, which as you said, is IAFCEMS.org.
Great.
So,
I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank you for being with us. And before you go, I just want to mention I just added your lieutenant, Jim Logan, on the line, one of our authors. And Jim's going to spend a little bit of time talking with us this evening about what's going on back at home with the flooding in Memphis.
Oh, well, I tell you what, I am so blessed as a deputy fire chief in Memphis to have such an excellent staff. And they make me look so good. And Jim Logan is one of those people. He's a lieutenant on my staff, and he makes me look so good all the time. I'm so blessed to have him on my staff.
Well, we're blessed to have him as an author also. And thanks for your time. I know you had to break away from a session to join us, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this evening.
Very good, Mike. You have a good day.
Thanks, Gary. Jim,
bye-bye.
Are you on the line?
Yeah, I just joined. You guys, actually, I'm trying to unblush and be humble. Thanks for the kudos from both of you. I appreciate that. Yeah, we're holding the fort down here in Memphis. We got a little water, but we're getting through it, and helping shelter a lot of individuals that have been displaced in the last.
Whoops. Oh, let me see. We just lost Jim there, and we'll probably get him back in a second. Mick, are you on the line there?
Am I on the line with you, Mike?
Good, good. I added you in there at some point while Gary was talking. So we're probably going to do some discussion. One of Jim's cohorts, Andrea, is on the other line, and I may add Andrea in here, and then Jim will call us back in a second. Mick is one of our other authors, and Mick, I guess you've completed your move to Colorado.
Yeah, we're settled in here now in Colorado, and I took a position with the Thornton Fire Department, which is a department just north of Denver. I've begun their academy, getting through the process of becoming a Thornton firefighter with them after leaving Sacramento, and just going through the whole process again. Definitely different to do at 41, but I'm enjoying it, and it seems like a great organization to be a part of, and we're excited on our end for sure.
Good, good. Well, is Andrea on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you this evening?
Good, good. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio. And I think we're going to get Jim back in a moment, and I guess he wanted you to join us this evening and talk a little bit about what's going on with the flooding back home. So,
hey, Mike, I'm back on.
Are you back on? Okay.
I'm back with you. I don't know what happened here, but I'm back. It's been kind of a week like that for the last little bit here. So I don't know where I left off with you guys, but we're sheltering a lot of people and using a lot of Metropolitan Medical Response system resources and getting people to safer, higher ground.
Good, good. Well, I added Andrea in, and she, I guess, is a coworker of yours in Memphis.
Andrea, I want you to we work closely together through the MMRS system in its mission now being linkages with the different healthcare communities, pre-hospital, hospital, public health, law enforcement, and others. So, we've been working together in the MMRS steering committee for probably the past 3 years now, trying to build those relationships within our healthcare community. So, Andrea is a RN with a hospital system here. I'll let her talk a little bit, and I'll shut up.
Okay. Hey, before we start, can we just clarify for our listeners, MMRS or MRS? What we're talking about with that? Some will understand, some don't.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's not like MRSA. It's not a staff infection. What it is is it's a federally funded program under the Urban Area Security Initiative grant program, and there are 124 Metropolitan Medical Response System or MMRS jurisdictions across the United States, and Memphis and Shelby County happen to be one of those 124 places. We It's a non-competitive grant. We receive funding every year. This year we received $321,000. And what we do, besides create relationships and linkages within our healthcare community, is we are able to purchase things for mass casualty incidents, things for you know, mass vaccinations and things like that. And Audrey, anytime you want to jump in.
We also look at training opportunities that normally are done more in a silo with different organizations, so we're able to bring EMS, fire, health, public health, hospitals together to do training to prepare for events like we are dealing with here in Memphis now.
So does MMRS, is there one that would cover every place in the states, or do they just cover certain areas?
It actually, historically, it's been the 124 areas. In the state of Tennessee, I know that we have four. We have Memphis, Nashville, Knoxville, and the Chattanooga area.
Okay. And so tell us a little bit. Either Andrea or Jim, maybe tell a little bit about what's the constituency of the team and what you're doing.
We have an executive committee that looks at what some of our needs are for the year in terms of equipment and supplies to respond to certain events, what some of our training gaps are and needs are, and where we can apply that money. And then we have representation on the committee from several hospitals, from all of the fire and EMS services within our UASI area. So we've got six counties that are included under our subcommittee, but we mainly focus on Shelby County in terms of how we utilize the dollars and strengthen the resources so that we can support those counties that are outside of our jurisdiction or that are bordering us.
So does that MMRS group have employees that work just for the group, or is it using similar to a DMAT team? People who are in other organizations that then are assigned to the group.
People within other organizations, but it's not really a DMAT team per se. That concept kind of changed over the years. So we look at how this community as a whole can use the equipment and supplies and make sure they're trained on it, as opposed to having a core group of people that would go out to respond. It's not really that type of strike team.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not the strike team type model. It's more of a pulling your common resources together, almost like a continuum of care. You know, we on the committee is law enforcement, EMS, health. Public health, hospital. Even the ME's office is even involved. So what you're really doing is bringing together your whole community, healthcare community, together closer for that common goal of responding to, you know, mass surge events or mass casualty events, much like what we're doing here with the flooding here. We have a small component that's really committed to the medical end of it, but more with this mission is more of a humanitarian type mission that we're taking on. We have five shelters that are open right now, and we're coordinating through our ESF 8 function at our Emergency Operations Center, the care for those evacuees. But we've also set up a base of operation, which we manage all of our shelters through, and we're using all of our MMRS resources. We've got a couple Western shelter tents set up. People come here to get assigned to a shelter, and we're able to, from a lesson learned in Katrina, we're able to track those folks and where they're going, whether they're going to the hospital or whether they're going to a shelter. And we do that through an electronic patient tracking, or an evacuee tracking, if you will, for this situation. And that was, all those resources were purchased with MMRS funding.
One of the other things that that tracking system allows us to do is link family members, which was another huge lesson learned. Someone is looking for their granddaughter or their niece. We have the ability to at least tell them this person or this group of people have reported to this shelter or that shelter, so that we don't have families splintered and searching frantically to find one another.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I would encourage any of the listeners who might have a question for Jim or Andrea to give us a call, and you can call into the talk radio show here this evening on area code 7-8852 or toll free at area code 877-497-3973. And you're listening to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. This is Fire Medically Speaking. I'm Mike McAvoy, the EMS editor and the host. And Jim or Andrea, what would you say has been your biggest issue to contend with the flooding from a perspective of public safety?
Well, right now, talking to you with these sirens going off, what about that? you'll have to forgive me. I'm at our base of operations here at the pretty much the center of our city. So the question is, what has been our biggest challenge with the flooding?
Yeah, what would you say would be your biggest thing that you've had to deal with from a perspective of continuity of operations for fire and EMS?
You know, really, this we've been through a couple of rodeos like this before with the Gustav evacuation and some other local emergencies, and I would say that you know, we're really able to, through our linkages created with MMRS, we're able to work through most of those major issues that, you know, most of the continuity problems. I mean, wouldn't you agree, Andrea? We've had
yeah,
you know, a couple bumps in the road, but you know, we've come a long way, and to have a group of people committed to help run this, and the community to understand the importance of those linkages and how important it is to work together as one when things like this occur. It's worked pretty seamlessly, actually.
I think one of the biggest benefits for us is that we have spent so much time over the past couple of years working towards being able to accomplish what we're doing right now. If we did not have the MMRS funds and we had not looked at being able to do something where all of your normal hardened fixed structures were unavailable, I don't know that we would be able to talk to you right now, because I think we would still be trying to juggle a lot of balls and have a lot of plates spinning in the air and not being successful. The MMRS funds have allowed us to really be successful in managing what could be a major catastrophic event, and really controlling that chaos.
That's good to hear. That's probably helpful to you, too, from a perspective of your relations with the community.
Hey, Mike. It's Nick.
Yeah.
I got a question
ahead,
for them.
Yeah, go ahead,
on
Nick.
The scheme of what they're doing with their MMRS, how much of the coordinating and putting together the operation has really come from those hard lessons learned during Katrina? And have you been able to pull from some of the experience of the people who tried to manage Katrina to build your system to be as effective as it is?
I would say, you know, we talk about a lot about Katrina, we talk a lot about 9/11, and we're fortunate to have a task force here and a lot of people that did respond to both of those events. And people here that were here locally, I mean, due to our location, you know, we got a lot of evacuees from Katrina. I myself was on Tennessee Task Force 1 and was on the first day of operations at 610 and I-10 in Louisiana down at the 9th Ward. So you bring those lessons learned home. So they're huge, actually. I don't know if that answers your question, Mick, but a lot of us have had that experience, and the core group of people that are on the steering committee have learned, you know, for instance, one of the first things that we started doing when we really started ramping this thing up was the patient tracking. It's not a perfect system, but nothing electronic is, as I got cut off a while ago. I mean, nothing's perfect, you know, cell phone coverage or whatever, but it allows us to track folks. And I remember the stories that came out of Katrina that, you know, the only way we had to track people sometimes that when we evacuated nursing homes was just a Sharpie marker. You know, I came from this nursing home. These folks were unable to speak or communicate in any way. And this way, with the electronic patient tracking system that we use from DMS Disaster Management Solutions, it allows us to keep up with everybody. And you know, fortunately, this is a pretty bad event for our community. But it's not catastrophic like it was at Katrina, and this helps us prepare for those types of events.
One of the other things
like
that we learned, I'm sorry, Mike,
go ahead.
Jim had one side of the Katrina experience while he was in Katrina and helping to respond. I was on the other side here receiving those evacuees, so I was part of that whole flood of getting people off a train and blah, blah, blah. And so when you've got people on the committee who have been in the same event but taking in all of the information and processing it and then bringing it back to the group, we're able to really say, how can we handle the getting people out and the receiving people in and do that more efficiently? And so then Gustav happened, and we again had people who were out on the let's get them out of the danger, and us on the end, let's bring them in to safety and make some other changes. And we realized after Katrina pretty quickly that we were going to have to do something better than pen and paper and shooting from the hip, because when you've got hundreds of thousands of people whose safety and their lives depend on the decisions you make and how you respond to them, it was important for us to start looking at how we could streamline processes and put things in place that would allow us a lot more flexibility and a lot more ease in managing such a large volume or such a large influx, whether it was coming into our city or having to mobilize and get them out of areas of danger in our city.
Great. That sounds like, when you were talking about the tracking system, is that EMS tracking system, that was one of the things that you got with the MMRS funds and had in place prior to the incident occurring?
Yes, prior to this one. We actually had started looking at a system right after Katrina as a community and as a state, and we evaluated several and went with DMS as our option. And when Gustav hit, we had just ordered the starting equipment and software. And the company called just before the evacuation started and said, hey, you know, we understand you guys are going to receive evacuees and your equipment's not ready, but we can get you some loaner equipment. Do you want to start using it? And so without any training to the group, without setting up how we thought things should be, they came down. We started using it from day one, and we have been tweaking it and perfecting it and making it a more robust system, so it's not just about tracking patients in an MCI or tracking evacuees, but we can use it for everyday uses, like tracking your flu vaccinations for an engine house or for a hospital, using it for educational tracking as well, so that you're really going away from all this pen and paper, but you're using a system that people can put their hands on every day in normal activities so that when you need it in an emergency, they're more familiar with the equipment. So it has grown and really become a lot more than we ever thought that the system would be for us.
That's
I have
nice
one question
hear.
On that. With the tracking of the patients, when you're tracking either evacuees or the patients, is there a permanent something that's affixed to them as well, be it a wristband, a necklace, some type of an identification number, so if they end up at another place, they can continue the tracking and the progress of that individual, then it stays
yes.
in your system? Or is it once they're entered with a name, you know where they went, and you track them from that following system?
if they come to us from New Orleans with an armband, we would continue that same unique identifier and just integrate that in so that if we are pushing information back to the Phoenix system or back to some of the other systems that we've been working with to test to provide information back and forth, the number doesn't ever change so that you don't lose that continuity of knowing about this person from the beginning of the event to the end of the event. Now, for us, if we're doing evacuations, we're using wristbands. For MCIs, we're using triage tags. Or if we have someone that's been evacuated but they need to go to a hospital before they go to a shelter, we would use a triage tag. But we keep that same unique identifier with them.
So is that like a barcode identifier also that's easily scanned, or does it have to be numerically put into the computer to be tracked?
Our system is a barcode system, and it will allow us to use either the wireless system in a batch mode where you just dock it into a cradle that's connected to a laptop or a desktop, or we could use a tethered scanner on a laptop. You can't manually enter the information directly into a laptop if you didn't have scanners. So let's say you were set up in a shelter, you could just go online and start entering people in. We also have the ability to scan the back of a driver's license and actually pull data off of the driver's license to get the person's name, their date of birth, their age. And depending on the configuration of the license itself, it may give you their address as well. We don't immediately collect that even in an evacuation situation, but we could turn those elements on if we needed to, or the vendor could do that for us. So it really frees us up from having to do a lot of manual entry. So the less you have to put in, or the better your information is, so that you don't have someone transpose letters or numbers or what have you. You're going to have clean data.
Nice. That's a similar system to what we're actually using in New York State for vaccine clinics when we set up these closed pods to provide vaccination to our fire, EMS, and police. We have a scanner now that's a statewide system similar to that that takes all the data right off the driver's license, which is a phenomenal time savings and throughput for those clinics.
Right.
Yeah,
so we
did the same thing here, Mike, with our vaccinations too, with our closed pods with fire, police, and health. We use these scanners. We have the ability to you have different drop down boxes on your scanner, and you can, one would be for sheltering, another would be for pods, the other one would be for MCI events. So you're able to switch seamlessly for whichever case you need to, and it stores the information in the handheld scanner itself, and then you can drop it in the cradle and it goes directly to the server. The way we have it set up here, with the flooding event we've got, we just have a central location that the evacuees can come to, and then we're able to manage the surge of each shelter by them coming to a central location. They're scanned in here, information taken here. They're sent out to either by Metropolitan bus or by car if they have a car, and then they're scanned into the system that the shelter receives. So we're able to keep up and manage the number of people in each shelter too, so we don't overburden one shelter versus another. So it allows us to evenly distribute our evacuees to these shelters that we have open. But we use it for the pods as well too, and it worked out very well and for record keeping purposes.
That's great. So what's the status of your situation now? Like our understanding from the media is that you're probably reached the peak of flooding and now you're in a situation where you're starting to see things rescind a little?
Yeah, I think it crested at close to 48 feet, and it really affected the Mississippi, but you got all the tributaries that come off of it, and that's what really reached into the neighborhoods. So it is going down each day, but the water will be with us for quite some time. I'm not sure exactly what the last count was, but I think we're close to sheltering at least, what, Andre, would you say about 600 people?
Yes.
Yeah.
And those are just the people that are in shelters, not counting the people who had alternative means when the flooding first started. But anticipating that as this continues and the water's still in their homes over the next week, there may be more people who are going to need shelter assistance.
So some of that's going to end up being pretty long term, right?
Yeah, our shelters were set up with the thought that many of these residents could potentially be there 3 weeks or so, because they know that the water won't really start to really appear to be out of those areas for at least 4 to 10 days after the water crested. So, you know, they could be in those shelters even after the water's gone, because, you know, you've got the cleanup and the homes, if they, you know, had water in them at all, they've got to deal with the mud and the gunk and the mold and those types of things. So this is not something that, because the water's crested, we are now out of the woods and people can go, woohoo, I can go home tomorrow.
Right, right. And the logistics, as all of us know from trying to run shelters, is not a simple matter. You have an awful lot of concerns from day to day, healthcare issues and sanitary issues and feeding people. And that certainly is a challenge, I'm sure, logistically. Have you had any fire stations or EMS stations that have been affected by the flooding?
I've got some pictures on my Facebook page, but I can send you some. Our training academy, I came, and I'm not kidding, inches from being totally flooded. It is up to the front door right now, so we had to sandbag our training academy, which is a pretty large facility, pretty state-of-the-art facility, and so we almost lost it and our police academy. We've had to sandbag around some fire stations and evacuate. We came close to evacuating some of those as well, but up to the doors with water on most of those structures. So we've been pretty fortunate.
Right. How about healthcare facilities? Have you had hospitals or nursing homes that you've had to close down or move out of?
There have been two private care group homes that did have to relocate, so we did make sure that they were able to get into one of our facilities and kind of take over a space and use that. Hospitals, fortunately, did not have to relocate. We did have a few surgery centers and clinics that were affected by the flooding early on, but have been able to get back to normal operations over the past week. So hospitals themselves, fortunately, fared very well, but we were always on heightened alert that we may have to make some changes and some move patients around in a couple of areas had the waters continue to rise and we continue to get rain. So when the rain stopped, that really helped the hospitals out a great deal.
That's great. You had mentioned earlier, Andrea, that there were some lessons learned. Are there any things you'd like to share with the listeners that were things you hadn't intended on that you found yourself having to deal with, or things you would do differently if you confronted this issue again?
Well, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men is always a great way to open things. You know, we started our shelter assistance center with the thought that people who were going to have to evacuate could come to one place, and we only thought in one dimension, just those people who needed to get into a shelter. And we didn't consider the people who were potentially affected showing up asking questions. So thinking about not just that one element, but thinking about what other elements could affect us in the situation, which we'd be better prepared for. We were able to adjust, but we had an even flow of, I need a place to stay, and I'm not sure if I'm going to need a place to stay or not. Can you help me? So that definitely was a very quickly learned lesson, but something we were able to rectify. And then just from the floods we had last year, we learned that we were going to have really kind of a central point, and that's how we got to the shelter assistance center this year. We had some flooding, not as significant last year, but we had to do a lot more rescue last year, and we were able to get ahead of the game this year and really get the word out and the message out to people that your area is potentially in danger and we need you to start preparing for that. It made a huge difference and it allowed us to be able to prepare for sheltering and potentially sheltering large volumes of people compared to how we had to shelter last year.
Yeah, a lot of that came from the ability to the GIS mapping, which is funded through our UASI program, a Near Urban Area Security Initiative, and that was really helpful. We were able to, wish I could describe it better to you here, but we have three large western shelter tents set up in a parking lot of a mall, and basically one side of one of the western shelters is just for information only. If you want to see, and it's surprising that a lot of folks still don't have computers, but a lot of people, you know, are flooded out, and they want to come in and see what the affected areas look like. So they, the University of Memphis was able to use their GIS system and create mapping which showed what was going to be potentially flooded and what was definitely going to be flooded. And it was it had the ability to be updated, you know, hourly. So that made a huge difference. So when I say we've sheltered 600 people, that's how many people have come just seeking, I need to get out of my house and go to a shelter. But we've had probably three times that many people come in and just go to the information side of the large western shelter tent and say, you know, can you show me my zip code? And we were able to pull that zip code, that mapping up by zip code and by address, and show them, you know, what they need to be looking for.
Have you guys had the options of using any of, like, the reverse 911 systems for alerts or pre-alerting, maybe an information passing system to do that reverse 911, get the information out and give some people a little bit of additional, you know, heads up as to what was coming?
Yeah, we used reverse 911. I don't know if they used it in this instance, Andre. We've been kind of stretched here. Between the two places, our emergency operations center is probably about 10 miles from where our shelter assistance place is, and I haven't been to every briefing. I don't know if they use the reverse 911. I know they use it by zip code, but media has been very, very helpful. And we were able to prepare for it. I don't know, Andre, do you want to answer that question?
They use that if you are going to target all of that particular, let's say the 212 area code or zip code, I'm sorry. And because this was so random, if you will, in even one zip code, instead of using that reverse 911, it was easier to go actually door to door and make sure that people got a notice that your area is definitely in danger. So they drilled it down because it was really important and imperative that certain areas got the message, that it wasn't relying on somebody leaving a message on a voice, an answering machine, but that there was a person who could see this big notice and say, I need to pay attention. So there was a lot of discussion about using that. We have City Watch, which is also an alert notification system, but they wanted to make sure in this instance that communication still was not lost. So in other events, we have used it, especially when we've had, you know, chemical releases and you wanted to make sure near DuPont that those residents stayed put, and that was, I need you to know this immediately. But in this case, we really stuck more to the let's get it out in the media, blast them as much as we can with as much information, referring them to staysafeshelby.us. Please go to the website, go to the library. 211 was used a lot, which is our links or our information provided through the library so that people could get information over and over and over again. I mean, we really have bombarded people with information, probably some would say almost overload. But it's been extremely effective because folks who would normally not pay attention, the tornado sirens are going off or the alert sirens, they were really saying, you know, I need to ask questions and get more information and take this seriously.
That's great. Well, so for people who are joining us, you're listening to Lieutenant Jim Logan from Memphis Fire Department and Andrea Merriweather, who is with the MMRS system. Both of them have been talking about their experience dealing with the flooding in Memphis and the consequence management of that. And so we're hearing some interesting information about their response to that situation. At this point, why don't we take a brief break? I'll play a short little commercial, and then we'll come back to the program. For people who are interested in calling in, the call-in numbers are 760-454-8852, or you can call in toll-free to area code 877-497-3973.
When you're not listening to Fire Engineering Talk Radio, get online to fireengineering.com and check out the Fire Engineering Network. Get the best in training, news, video, and community in the fire service today. The best source for training and information on the World Wide Web, fireengineering.com. Now back to Fire Engineering Talk Radio.
I was just checking on our blog page to see if we had any chat messages for Jim or Andrea, and I don't see anything new on there that we haven't talked about already. So I don't really want to hold you guys up. I know you have work to do, and so if you have other things you want to talk to us about, if not, I appreciate your both calling in and taking some time to share with our listeners the work that you've been doing for the last few weeks there in Memphis.
I don't have any additional to add to you, Jim.
No, I'm good. I'm good. Hey, Mike, hey, thanks for having us on. I'll be talking to you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so
thanks.
Much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Mick,
thanks
see you later.
Coming.
Take care, Jim. Good luck down there, and I hope everything goes well for you guys.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Certainly all of our listeners are thinking about the work of Memphis Fire and the emergency services in Memphis, and our thoughts and prayers go out to the many people in the community that are affected by the flooding throughout the United States, Memphis as well as the other places where we're experiencing some pretty catastrophic flooding. So, Mick, you're still there?
I am still here.
Let me tell you about some interesting things that we heard about here at the conference in Vegas this week. The folks from OnStar were here and have done actually three presentations. I think we're about to hear some pretty exciting stuff from them over the course of the next few months. They have a neat new device. So most of our listeners are probably familiar with OnStar, a product in the General Motors cars that pretty heavily advertised. You push the OnStar button, or when you have a crash, it automatically alerts the 911 center and opens up a line where you can talk to them. So now OnStar has a product that's a coupon for your mirror, your rearview mirror in your car, which takes all the OnStar features and puts it into that little device, and you can to some of the big box stores in another month or so and buy this clip-on device for any car and put it on the mirror and have the accessibility to the OnStar features. And if you're in a crash, it actually has a sensor that would detect the deceleration, the rollovers, that sort of thing, report the same kind of data as the sensors in the GM cars, and hopefully enhance the information that responders are getting, which is a pretty exciting piece of information. So
yeah, that seems very advanced and super proactive by the people at OnStar. And I think the thing we really have to take into consideration is when we're dealing with trauma, it's all about that first hour after the injury and the impact, getting them into the place where they can have an OR, they can have definitive treatment. And if this can shorten that time frame down, we're only doing better things for the people that we serve. What a great move by them, and a great direction for them to travel.
Yeah, and they're working with the CDC. I know you know Mick from the things I send out for our authors that we've really been looking for somebody for the last years to write a little bit about this whole mechanism of injury prediction scores, and folks who are involved in the administrative end of the fire service or EMS know that these centers that collect information from vehicles, OnStar being one of them. There are other services that do that, have been working with an algorithm for the last probably 4 or 5 years. Rick Hunt, who is a researcher at the Centers for Disease Control in Injury Prevention, has a series of grants that have actually looked at things that are pieces of data you can consolidate to provide information to a 911 center that have given us this information that we see now, like, for example, Delta V, the change in velocity of a vehicle, before and after a crash. The number comes into a lot of 911 centers, is integrated with the medical priority dispatch information that people who are using Dr. Clausen's system will get a Delta V sometimes transmitted through that or through their dispatch center to give them some more information about how much deceleration was involved. Sometimes we get rollover information if that occurred. Sometimes we know how many occupants were in the vehicle from sensors that send that information. And what OnStar is doing now is trying to take all those pieces of information and incorporate them into a score that would actually be a piece of information we could understand when your typical responder going to an incident and say, based on this score, I could tell you how bad these people are going to be injured when I arrive on the scene. And that's pretty interesting information. And I'm hoping that we can get an author to put together an article about that for a future issue of Fire Engineering. I think we got the right people now involved with that. But they've done some really fascinating presentations on the technology here at Fire Rescue Med, and it's been interesting to watch.
Well, I think the progression of this whole thing started probably in the late 80s and the early 90s when we're talking about mechanism of injury. We had the hospitals. You know, what did the car look like? How can you describe the car? What was the intrusion? Where was the damage? How many times did it roll? And we got to that point where all of a sudden we started moving towards putting Polaroid cameras inside of some of our ambulance units so that you could take a photograph of that car so you could vividly paint the picture to the hospital as to what the damage was. And I think with this new information, maybe we're going to end up in an environment where now the manufacturer can automatically transmit that information to a hospital or to a first responder to say, this is the amount of damage that was inflicted on the vehicle, these are the forces, this is how many G-force each occupant took, this is where their impacts were. That information is gigantic when we start doing that predictor of injury, and I think it's a great progression from where we started back in, you know, the late 80s and early 90s with Polaroid cameras as the beginning.
I agree with you, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you used that analogy, because when I had talked to Rick Hunt about this, when the CDC first started getting involved in that a technology and that sort of assessment and saying, you know, what are the numbers that make a difference when we're looking at injury and mechanism? Rick's comment was, in the past we did take a Polaroid camera and take a picture, and, you know, we're trying to do that in a much more sophisticated manner. And you almost wonder, when you think about that technology and the kind of information that's coming across, I see two issues with it. One is that I don't know necessarily that a medic who's arriving at a scene has as much information available to him as the 911 center might have had, and they collect that computerized information directly from the vehicle through their collection systems. So you almost wonder if that information isn't going to be more reliable than, you know, what you or I would be able to tell just by looking at a scene and looking at a patient. And then I think the issue that stems from that, the other side of the coin, is how do you get that to the responder and how do you get that to the hospital, as you mentioned, so that people can actually make some use of it?
I think there's two sides of that. There's the critically injured patient. And for the critically injured patient, we can look at them and say, yeah, you're critically injured. You've got this and this and this. And that, together with your vital signs and your mental status and your Glasgow coma score, I put all these things together, you're a critical patient. It's those patients that are the borderline patients, the patients that are kind of critical or almost meet criteria, that when we know the amount of force that they've been subjected to in that motor vehicle collision, we can have a better predictor of their injuries and we can make a better decision for them long term, getting them to that level one, level two trauma center. Or maybe the numbers say they're not critically injured. They can go to a different hospital and we don't impact those trauma centers and we can leave them available for the more critical patients later. Just an incredible opportunity with a large amount of information that could be provided to us down the road.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think it ties in a little bit to this trauma triage scheme that the Centers for Disease Control pushed out a couple of years ago. And really the clear evidence that came from the studies that led to the trauma triage scheme was that if you took a patient to an appropriate center, that you actually improved survival, and not improved survival a little, but dramatically improved survival of those patients. And I think that this is going to tie into that in a big way and say, you know, here's a patient, we're going to flag this patient by data that we get, crash data, that says you got a high-risk patient. This patient needs to go to an appropriate facility. And I can almost see that saving more lives than some of the technology that we put into the vehicles. You know, I was always very disappointed when airbags came out because I sort of saw an end to some of the horrible trauma that we like to work on as medics. But, boy, that technology has saved a lot of lives. I almost see this as being the new edge. You know, this is going to be something that will give patients a real competitive advantage when it comes to survival.
And how many times have we seen that patient out of what looked like a moderate mechanism motor vehicle collision that may or may not have had a loss of consciousness? We take them to a facility that's not a level one trauma center because they don't meet triage criteria based upon their injuries, and we find out 6-7 days later that they were seen at that facility, discharged, and then ended up dying 3 to 4 days later from like a small epidural or a small aortic tear. And those things aren't going to be missed at your level one trauma centers. And with the information that you're talking about, we can have those predictors and we won't miss those anymore.
Right. Yeah. We'd definitely kick yourself in the butt when you see something like that happen. That's a big, big problem. So, we're getting to about an hour into the show, and I know we talked last week about trying to limit the amount of time that we keep on the air. I'd say if we take a few more minutes, if there's folks who want to call in with topics they'd like to discuss, we could take some calls. And if not, I think we'll get ready to call it an evening. And I would just point out to listeners that the Fire EMS section of the Fire Engineering website is continuing to grow and expand. And listen to Jim Logan, lieutenant from Memphis Fire Department, on the air a little while ago. Jim is a columnist with our engine company EMS section. Real practical, down-to-earth tips for responders who are delivering EMS day in and day out. And we, Mick Messaline, who's on the line with me now, is another one of our authors. And Mick's published an article in the print magazine back in February on fire and EMS systems and response paradigms. And we have some other authors who are going to be actually running the show times when I'm not here and joining us on future shows. Karen Owens, who is one of our authors from Virginia, will be on with us probably on our next show. And I think Aaron Dean actually is going to join us. He's also from the left coast, and I guess you kind of left him back there, Mick, huh?
Yeah, he's hanging out there and by himself now. I moved back to the middle so I can be more neutral.
So, and Aaron is a firefighter paramedic with, where are we, Sacramento, is that it?
Correct.
Yeah, and so Aaron's been an author on and off. He's done some things on the web, done some things in the print magazine, and he'll definitely join us. And then we'll see Jim Logan on and off. So we'll have a little team of folks that will kind of tag team running the show in the future, and feel free to send us comments through the blog, through the Fire Engineering website at fireengineering.com. And if you have topics that you're interested in, we're going to bring some other folks on future radio programs in to talk about issues that we think are important, and maybe talk a little bit about things that they think are important as well. So we'd like to hear from you if there's information that you'd like to hear about or people you want to hear on the show. We certainly can get them and bring them in to share their knowledge and information with you. So anything you want to add, Mick?
I did have one question about the conference that you're at, and I don't know if you could ask somebody about this while you're there. I think it's a good little thing for thought. Are they bringing in either current or former managers of the private ambulance sector to talk to some of these chiefs about the management side of their ambulance companies? Because I know in the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of what has happened in EMS with the fire service, A, we can do it very well. We can provide the service and we have a ton of resources, but it's also become an additional revenue stream. And there's nobody better at generating that revenue stream than these managers from the private ambulance companies. And maybe that would be a good thing to bring in and have as part of the educational package at the conferences, some of the current or retired managers from those systems.
That's a good question. And, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because just this afternoon I was in a session with Mike Metro, who's a chief of Los Angeles County Fire Department in their EMS division. And Mike was doing a session on how to change the culture of the fire service to embrace EMS. It's kind of interesting because everyone in the room was someone who wanted to change the culture, not necessarily the people who didn't want to change the culture. You'd probably have to drag them in kicking and screaming. But amongst that crowd, it was kind of an interesting exchange, because there were three or four current chiefs or assistant chiefs of EMS in departments from around the United States who had worked as managers in commercial services in the past, and had been hired specifically for that reason. You know, they had worked for AMR, worked for Rural Metro, or worked for one of the other commercial services, and now they're running an EMS program for a fire department and, you know, facing some of the same challenges as the rest of us are with culture in the fire department. But I think the answer to your question is yes, they are, you know, attempting to tap some of that expertise and help people to improve their management skills from that information.
I mean, if we're going to use it as a revenue stream to help keep our stations open, to help hire people, to buy equipment, all of those things are only made better if we have, you know, guidance from the people who have made it happen in the past. And obviously, we're not going to start doing interfacility transfers and things like that. That's going to take away from our 911 service. But at the same time, how do we maximize our 911 service to provide the very best we can while generating the most amount of revenue to protect our budget, to protect our brothers and sisters, and make sure that we keep our houses open and we don't have to cut community services?
And that, you know, that exact topic was, there were at least a dozen talks here in the last few days that were targeted right at that, exactly at that sort of thing. How do you make a better quality product? How do you do things cost efficiently? How do you explain to the community, you know, what your value is? How do you show the community that you actually deliver high quality care? And then how do you lease that to yourself so that you distinguish yourself as a service that delivers a product, that real high quality product and value for the price that you're paying? So, and as Gary Ludd mentioned earlier when he talked about the conference, it's not very clinical here at all. You know, it's managerial, administrative, and it's talking about exactly those kind of things that you mentioned, Mick.
So, that's a good thing. I think that was something we really, when we got into EMS and the fire service, we didn't look at, you know, it's, hey, this guy's a chief, he's been a good chief, he can manage these guys, we'll do well. But then we start figuring out, this isn't just a, you know, $50 business a week. These can be multi-million dollar entities that are going to provide a lot of revenue stream for the fire service, and the better we manage them and the better we educate those who are managing them, the better they're going to produce and the better results we're going to get from them. And I think that's only a benefit for us long term.
Yeah, Absolutely, definitely. So thanks for joining me, Mick.
Anytime. And,
we look forward to
our next meeting. I think we've got a practice meeting, I think, in about a week.
Yeah, we're going to get the four or five of us together and have our own little radio show so that we don't create any more faux pas like when we disconnected Jim earlier. If that's something we did, I'm not sure. A lot of buttons here to push on this screen.
Well, you're putting firemen in charge of computers and radio shows, and there's definitely bound to be some problems associated with that. But we all learn and adapt quickly, and I think that the end result is obviously going to be showing what everybody's put into it, and I think that's only going to be a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think, you know, listen to the other shows that are going on, and I say, you know, hey, if some of these folks like Rick Lassie and John Salka can control all these electronics, I think probably us EMS guys can figure it out at some point, too. They just they probably could work on the controls so they have a little more firematic feel to them, I would say.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Mick, and thanks to our listeners for tuning in. The podcast of this or archive of it will remain on the site. You can link to that at fireengineering.com. And you're listening to Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Today is Friday, the 13th of May, 2011. Mick Messelin is on with me, one of the Fire Engineering EMS authors, and I'm Mike McAvoy, the Fire Engineering EMS technical editor. So thank you again for joining, and good night to everyone who's here.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio.